Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in internet radio land, podcast land. This is John Stanko, your host for Wake Up to Purpose. This is our second week back in the saddle after taking a few years hiatus, but I'd say it's good to be back, but certainly a sobering time, and I don't want to be too upbeat and in light of the fact that some people are fighting for their lives. Many people are fighting for their economic lives, facing tremendous uncertainty. And so we want to be mindful of that. At the same time, we want to do what we can to equip ourselves to get through this season, both physically and emotionally and spiritually, and we want to prepare for the future. And today, I've got a special guest who is going to talk to us about economics, and we'll be bringing him on in a moment. But Russ McCullough is the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics at Ottawa University and also the founder and director of the Gwartney Institute for Freedom, Justice, and Human Flourishing. And so I've spent time with Russ. I've traveled with him, and on this second week, I can't think of anybody I'd rather have come on and talk to us about some of the economic state of affairs and get his take on where we are and what is happening. I hope you had a good weekend, or as good as you could have had. And I heard from some of our friends and partners in Kenya. They are engaging social media with a fervor that has not been seen before. And I posted on Facebook last week that I think it's ironic that God in many ways has taken everything away from us except social media. We even have gas, but we have no place to go. We're all dressed up, and we don't have any place to go. And, of course, if you've followed any of my material for the last 2 years, you know that I've been a voice in the wilderness saying that the church and individuals need to embrace social media for what it is, a great publishing broadcasting tool. And that's what I've tried to do over the last dozen years, and so I feel like I'm ready. And I've been talking on my Facebook Live, reading excerpts out of my book, Put Me In, Coach, Living a Bold Life. And so before we had an option of whether to use it, now we don't. But suddenly we're finding that it still has deficiencies, but in the minds of and the experience of many people that I'm talking to, it's better than they thought. And so so last week or when a week before that, when I was thinking what can I do to contribute to the discussion that's going on in online and in the world, I thought I'll just take a small step and reinstitute blog radio. And as I said, I'm also doing a daily Facebook Live. I am posting many, many posts throughout the day as I think of things that may challenge and encourage people all over the world. And I'm hearing from people many different places. And Africa is pretty much asleep right now, but they'll be listening by recording tomorrow, and we'll be getting feedback from them from this show. Now, if it's your first time tuning in, or if it's not, let me just say that our tradition is to read Psalm 91 as we start the show, and I've been doing this on Facebook Live, and this is the psalm, the subtitle in this particular translation, which is the New Century Version, is Safe in the Lord. And I have shared on a few occasions that a number of years ago when I was teaching at Kabul University in Afghanistan, things were very tense, and we were in danger, and we didn't know how much danger we were in till right towards the end of when we were leaving. But every morning, we started with a convocation, a gathering. There were about 25 of us, and we would talk, and we would pray, and we read Psalm 91, and I was just, I'll always remember how it focused us, how it grounded us for the day. And so just bear with me as I read this, and if you're not a person of faith, just receive it as a as good poetry that has been around for about 2,700 years, about 3,100 years. So it has stood the test of time. Here's the New Century Version. Those who go to God Most High for safety will be protected by the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, you are my place of safety and protection. You are my God, and I trust you. God will save you from hidden traps and from deadly diseases. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you can hide. His truth will be your shield and protection. You will not fear any danger by night or an arrow during the day. You will not be afraid of diseases that come in the dark or sickness that strikes at noon. At your side, 1,000 people may die or even 10,000 right beside you, but you will not be hurt. You will only watch and see the wicked punished. The Lord is your protection. You have made God Most High your place of safety. Nothing bad will happen to you. No disaster will come to your home. He has put his angels in charge of you to watch over you wherever you go. They will catch you in their hands so that you will not hit your foot on a rock. You will walk on lions and cobras. You will step on strong lions and snakes. The Lord says, whoever loves me, I will save. I will protect those who know me. They will call to me and I will answer them. I will be with them in trouble. I will rescue them and honor them. I will give them a long, full life, and they will see how I can save. Now, this is not a license for us to run out and do crazy things and to prove that that's true, but we declare it's true. One of our Urban Press authors wrote me this morning, and she and her son and her grandson all had the coronavirus. And she had pneumonia last week, but she was glad to report that they are on the other side. And she was thinking and talking Psalm 91. And sometimes we need something to hold on to in desperate times. And there's nothing wrong. People say, well, faith is just just for the weak. Yes, it is. And we have found out the world over just how weak we are. That something that we can't even see could bring the world to its knees. And literally, we are seeing a world at war. The war, however, is not against an ideology. It is not against a political system or philosophy. This war is against something we cannot see. It is a virus that is capable of felling the small and the significant. I just checked online, and Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the UK, has his condition has worsened, and they've put him in intensive care. So, yes, faith is for the weak, and we are not ashamed to say that. Anyway, that's how we start every show. Right now, I want to give our guest as much time to talk to us as possible. So let me welcome Dr. Russ McCullough to Wake Up to Purpose. Dr. Russ, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Yes. I guess first, let's...
Thanks for that. Thanks for that wonderful intro. Sorry, I was delayed in saying that.
No,
but,
thank you.
The psalm was nice and good reassuring words during these times. I'm not sure
indeed.
I'll have the same reassuring words when you start asking me about the economics of this thing.
yeah, indeed. Well, we may have to read it again at the end of the show and, to get our bearings back. I guess there may not be much to report, but you live in Ottawa, Kansas. What's the mood down there? What are you hearing? What's the news saying? What's the atmosphere like?
Well, here in the middle of the country, it's not too bad. Kansas is one of the early states to do the stay-at-home order, which did allow us to still go to the stores and get essential items. And most importantly for me, not only was it allowed, but encouraged to do things like fishing, which happens to be my favorite leisure activity. So I've been able to keep my sanity that way by hitting the lakes. And so people are encouraged to go out and bike ride or, you know, walk around, get some exercise. So we're not, you know, really confined the way some of the stories I hear of people maybe, you know, that are living in densely populated areas that one of my students, Claudio in Spain, has only gone outside twice in the last 25 days, and they don't even have a deck or anything off of their condo. So just a window. So I feel pretty blessed to be able to do what we're doing here. And I think in general, you know, people are the normal level of concern, but I wouldn't say freaking out, I guess. You know, I think everybody goes through periods where they feel more stressed than other, but I think in general, the mood and the tone here in Kansas is that we'll work through it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are a professor at Ottawa University, and the campus is shut down, and you are teaching from home. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. It's been a new world for teaching. So for Ottawa, we were pretty fortunate to have a fairly robust online system. I've been an online instructor since I started at Ottawa 9 years ago, and I'm also known as the quote-unquote high-tech professor, which I'm really not. But relative to some of my faculty colleagues, I do know a little bit more than the average Joe. So it was a pretty easy transition for me. A lot of my content was already available in some of the course shelves that I had created. And then I was familiar with video conferencing. So we've continued to hold our normal schedule with the students. So I get on class at the same time I would have been face to face. And so a lot of their patterns and schedules have stayed the same with Ottawa University. They're not just, you know, getting emailed homework and have to turn it in blindly and not have communication. So I think that's been real nice. The way our support team at Ottawa's really worked out well for that.
Yeah. Now you said you have a student in Spain. How has that worked out? Did he go home for break, or how is that working?
Yeah. Another case where somebody didn't take my advice. I told him not to go, but you know, I didn't know all of the various family pressures he had, but his grandfather got the virus, and then his dad probably had the virus, I think, at the time he left. And so he, right when things were starting to look, they booked him a flight and he went back home. And so, that's where he's at. But the family seems to be doing fine. But Barcelona is pretty locked down, it sounds like. So, it's fun. I get to see him. He joins my class, and I just saw him this afternoon at class. So, it's funny how we can work together now with the new technology.
Yeah, I know we're going to talk economics, and I know it's too early to come to any conclusions, but it seems like the forcing education to go online, it may have some repercussions and implications down the road. Would you agree?
Yeah, for sure. I honestly think it'll be beneficial ultimately. I guess maybe I'm the eternal optimist, but I know a lot of my faculty colleagues are learning the tools that I have found beneficial to be more efficient in communicating with my students. And so I think that'll be a positive. I think students are, you know, becoming more aware of how learning could be different. We'll see how the changes come. It's definitely going to create some changes. I think overall, the value of face-to-face content, true in-person content, so to speak, is still there. I think we need that as human beings. And so I think it'll be more of a value add rather than some sort of major, you know, substitution that this is the way we do things from now on. I don't think that'll happen. That wouldn't be my prediction.
Yeah. Now, you also teach at a graduate level, don't you? Tell us about that.
Yes, I teach a managerial economics class for our MBA program. I do that in different modalities. I teach it kind of face-to-face to traditional students on an eight-week schedule. I also teach the class online, which is strictly asynchronous, we call it, so that nobody has to be on at the same time, like we're doing this radio show. And then I also teach the executive MBA, where we meet for an intensive weekend and really cover a lot of material over a two-day weekend. And then the students go out to do assessments and chapter readings and stuff for the next 8 weeks. And then we convene one more time for their final projects. So teach that in a variety of ways. And that's a lot of fun, getting people who have experience in the real world and to see them connect the dots. I don't always get that with the undergraduates, where they haven't really been out in the real world to apply some of those economic principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Russ McCullough, who is the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics at Ottawa University in Kansas. And he's also the founder director of the Gwartney Institute for Freedom, Justice, and Human Flourishing. And Dr. Russ, I want to focus in on the Gwartney Institute just for a minute. Tell us a little bit about, the genesis of that and the purpose of it and what goes on within the Gwartney Institute.
Well, we originally, it was me, was thinking about increasing the economics department from 1 to 2 is kind of how it started off, and being able to look at the intersection of faith and economics is kind of a niche area that's always been a special interest of mine. And so the Gwartney Institute puts together a lot of student programming to kind of reach the masses with the good word of economics, is the way I like to say it. And so that helps with a recruiting arm for Ottawa University and the business school. And then it allows us various types of outreach to help people better understand how market principles make lives better and can lead to more human flourishing is ultimately the end goal, not GDP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is strictly within the university confines, or has it jumped off the track, so to speak, from the university and gone out to other places?
Oh, yeah, it's within the university, but the mission has always been to reach out as well. So I have a Faith in Economics podcast is one way that we get out to people around the world. John, you helped me with some of the research that we were doing with Kenya, and which was great, and I'm looking forward to diving more into those details. I haven't been able to hit it as hard as I want to. So how do freedom and, different institutions of government, different ways of doing business, so to speak, whether that's government business or real business, how that can impact lives in various countries around the world is some of the work that Jim Gwartney did. That we leverage into part of the Institute's work. And so we've done some reach out to churches. I've helped out some trade games and stuff with the United Way. And so it's definitely an overlap of both. I'd say our college students are one of the top priorities, and that would be for our existing students at the college with different programs. We have movie nights and reading groups and other activities that we do. That's kind of along the lines of retention and having fun with economics, and then also for the outreach to get new students. So lots of different things going on.
Yeah, and you've also done a little bit of travel, and you've, I think, taken some of the concepts and had a chance to present them in various international settings. So tell us a little bit about that.
So I've traveled to Guatemala and presented at a university there. We've continued to be able to show how these principles can really help lives and help people in their communities. And by using the Economic Freedom Index, you're able to pinpoint too strong of a word, but find areas that countries are weak in with the laws that they have or the types of taxes and amount of government intervention, whether they're open to international trade. And by doing that, you can really present a customized approach. I've also traveled, this is true along the states. I actually presented to the Kansas Senate Subcommittee on economic, I think that was on regulation. So you can really use the index to look at state level. It also goes down to the county level on laws that might be beneficial for people in different states. So I presented in North Carolina and Arizona. So do a little bit of traveling on that. That's not a major area, but it's certainly all out of the fun. I, as you know, I do like to travel.
Yes, we had a chance to go to South Africa together, and I can just tell our listeners, I've never seen anybody that enjoyed or squeezed more enjoyment out of a trip than I saw Dr. Russ. You jumped on buses and went fishing and went on a safari and did all kinds of things and made a presentation to pastors and leaders from 13 different nations. So you got your mileage out of that trip, didn't you?
Yes, yes. Carpe diem. Feast day has been one of my mantras for a long time, ever since the movie there with Robin Williams, I think. So.
Now, we're also thinking we hope to be doing something in late September in Malawi. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So Dr. Reggie Wanika has helped set up a trip there to talk to businesses and government leaders. I'm going to do a presentation again using the Economic Freedom Index to look at areas of improvement that could be done in Malawi. Similar to the work we did in Kenya, my real motivation is to try to get some of these concepts in to real people's hands and not just the leaders, because in some countries they might nod their head and say, yes, that sounds like a great idea, mm-hmm. and I understand, mm-hmm. and then nothing happens, because part of what I might be suggesting is taking away some of their current power and way of doing things, and changing the status quo is very difficult. So my mm-hmm. my strategy is to try to get this more at a grassroots level where we can ultimately get leadership in play if the current leaders aren't willing to change to get some of these policies instituted so that some of these countries can find flourishing similar to the way some of their neighbors do. I mean, if we look at a place like Chile, we wrote a little article on, there's been some civil unrest in Chile, which surprised me at first. And after doing a little research, we found out that their poor are doing much better than the poor right next door in Argentina and some of the other surrounding countries, because they are higher on the Economic Freedom Index. And so it's one thing to compare similar to what happens in the United States when if you're poor, you look at the rich people within your country and you say, hey, you've got something I don't. Mm-hmm. Which I think is what happened in Chile, but it might be more appropriate to compare poor people in different mm-hmm. institutions. And when you find that the poor are being lifted up as well as potentially the rich, the gap between the rich and the poor needs to be questioned on whether it's missing the mark or not. Because if we focus really on the poor, then these principles of economic freedom are the things to really look at.
And poverty is really a focus of yours, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. I always thought that what can we do to help people? Just giving handouts, of course, can create some incentives that don't work for long-term prosperity. And so the old teach a man to fish or give him a fish has been something that I've tried to change in my life. And I'm a part of some local groups here that try to allow a hand up for people in poverty to do some personal finance and some other things is the way I do some mm-hmm. some coaching in that regard. And it's been awesome to see the results that I've been able to do at that micro level to really mm-hmm. Help people kind of get off the system, so to speak, that where they might have been prone to go otherwise. So and don't get me wrong, certainly we free gifts of food and shelter are necessary in certain mm-hmm. circumstances, but to have a continual feed of handouts doesn't really bring a person to flourishing the way I think God intended us to try to help people.
Yeah. And now is this, I'm looking at your address for Twitter. Is this the Gwartney Institute address that says @123 poverty sucks?
It is. Yes. Yeah. We took a pretty strong stand there. I know it's a little sassy mm-hmm. and a little out there, but we wanted something to jump off the page and Also wanted something to appeal to young people was part of the reason for that tagline. So, yes, at 123, poverty sucks.
Yeah, so. So there you go. There's one way, and we'll talk more later. But if you're on Twitter, look at 123 Poverty Sucks, and that'll put you in touch with the Gwartney Institute for Freedom, Justice, and Human Flourishing. We're talking to Dr. Russ McCullough, who is the founder and director of the Institute and is also the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics at Ottawa University in Kansas. All right. We've laid the foundation of who you are and what you do. Now we need to talk to you as an economist and let you talk to us. What's going on?
Oh boy, I was hoping you could direct me a little bit better. I could. I'll throw a few things out there, and then you can add in. So I got thrown a question. You know, what does putting the economy on hold, like, is it possible to kind of stop the economy and not have any effects? And so, I think the length of the stopping time is key, and I think, you know, most people probably know that. But, you know, if we stopped the economy just as a thought experiment for 5 seconds, you know, would anything matter? And the answer, of course, it wouldn't matter at all. If we just stopped everything for 5 seconds, and so people will change their behaviors. You know, if you were in the middle of purchasing something, you could wait 5 more seconds to purchase the item. And so the substitution of purchases and economic activity over time is kind of key. And so the longer this epidemic goes on, the less substituting across time that we'll see, and we're losing out on a lot of the value creation that our market process brings. And I think that's going to become very aware. You know, people will think unemployment and that's bad. But every day, day in and day out, when we have voluntary trade, voluntary transactions of whether that's you working for your employer and getting a paycheck for doing the job that you do, or you going to Walmart to buy some things, all of that specialization in trade being voluntary is just creating value for human beings and allowing us to flourish better so that we can concentrate our activities on something that's more meaningful for us. And the government doesn't know like we know, right? Like each individual knows. And so when we have policies that are a little bit of a one-size-fits-all, that can cause real problems in terms of this value creation, because you no longer are utilizing knowledge that's contained in each individual human by letting them do what they think is best for themselves. They end up seeking out voluntary trades that make not only themselves better off, but because it's voluntary, makes another person better off. And so that relationship that we have with people is always creating value. And so with us having to stay in our homes, we're not getting that value creation like we do normally. And that is certainly not to say that this isn't the right thing to do, given the state of the spread and the virus. I'm certainly not saying that, but we are going to become very aware of the trade-offs that we're facing. And so at some point, if we can be more targeted with the pandemic through the evolution of tests so that we know who's sick, or, you know, being more vigilant on wearing masks everywhere we go, that there might be other ways to get more of that value creation started, to get people back to doing the things they're doing so that we don't cause other problems with the lack of income and lack of trades that are going to be there.
Yeah, I mean, we've never seen anything like this, so we don't have a lot of models to fall back on, do we?
No, we don't. We absolutely don't, that's for sure. And I think the other thing that's going to come to roost is the bailout package of $2 trillion currently, and I've heard people say that it might need to be $2 to $4 trillion more. So we're talking a total of 4 to 6. And that is absolutely unprecedented. And so I heard a commentator, I can't remember who to give credit to, but some of these, what economists call Keynesian models of, well, we just need to spend money. And so the government can step in with $2 trillion and spend this money, can be likened to trying to change the water level in the pool by scooping a 5-gallon bucket out of the deep end, but then pouring it back into the shallow end. So if we shuffle money around, that's not going to create this value creation that I was talking about earlier, where people are finding win-win situations. This is all ultimately amounting to transfer payments. So most of the stimulus package is all help to people, which is, by the way, I'm not anti-stimulus package to some degree either. But just to kind of lay out the economics of it, to have these transfer payments be borrowed will inevitably be pulling from people who aren't born yet by adding on to the national debt, which was already getting high. And I'm not a big debt alarmist either. But what I am an alarmist on is that the United States has a track record for the last plus years of pretty much running deficits year after year after year. So we're never charging enough tax dollars today to pay for our spending today in the last 40 to 50 years. And so that has been the accumulation of the debt. Again, if we stop doing that now, I don't think the current debt level is a deal breaker. We're the United States being one of the best borrowers out there means we have low interest rates. And so the level of the debt now is manageable, but to think about going another 50 years worth of deficits, eventually you have to pay the piper. And it does continue to pass the buck along to future generations, which brings up issues of fairness. Is it really right for us to be spending today money of people who aren't born yet? In the idea of transfer payments, if we're the logic, or I guess a fairness issue, is if it's kept within the generation. So if we are taxing the young today to give to the elderly, it's all within our time frame. And the young people today, you know, get some benefit out of knowing that grandpa and grandma are taken care of. But if we start to pass the buck on to their kids, they never even met grandpa and grandma. And so this intergenerational transfers is starting to become a bigger issue. And I think we're at that point where I think we'll learn from this that the government really can't just bail out situations very easily. And I think we learned some of that with the financial crisis in 2008 as well. With things like cash for clunkers that was passed, where the government was just passing out money and destroying used cars that were still usable. Those sorts of programs of just getting money out the door aren't very productive. And there should be better ways to create a nice safety net to help the people that really need the help. I'm not a big fan of the $1,200 across the board check that's going out to every American. Again, I think a more targeted approach for a fixed amount of money that's being spent could be targeted better to people who really need the help. It's just one example of kind of that one size fits all. Now, in the political arena, I very well know that maybe there's, you know, some sort of sentiment and keeping people optimistic or whatever, but I think there's plenty of room for improvement, and communication could be done in a similar way that does help cast a wide net and help the maximum amount of people possible that are really impacted directly by this pandemic.
Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Russ McCullough, who is the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics at Ottawa University in Kansas, also the founder and director of the Gwartney Institute for Freedom, Justice, and Human Flourishing. Dr. Russ, how do you watch the stock market? I mean, what do you think its role is it that big a deal? I mean, we lost huge. It's coming back. Is this more mental than anything? Is it playing a vital role in the economy? What's your take on that?
Well, So the one thing to keep in mind with the stock market is that it's only a small share of overall values of company that are being traded on any given day. So for example, if you've got a 100 shares of a stock, on any given day, there's only a few of those shares being traded. Most people are holding long term. And so if there's a sharp price change, a sharp price reduction like we've seen for some company, let me just pick Ford. It was the first thing that came to mind. So Ford Motor Company tumbles quite a bit on a given day. That's only because there's a fraction of the value of the company being traded. In other words, there's lots of people that are holding on to Ford long term. And so that price, once we get rid of the people who were motivated to sell or buy or whatever happened on that given day, the stock price can fluctuate a lot more, has a lot more volatility than the actual underlying value, the long-term value of the company. Because Ford, you know, hasn't changed the capital, the machines, the process, the people, the design,
leadership.
You know, all of that isn't changing on a day-by-day basis. So if the stock market does do a 5% drop in a given day, it's not that the real underlying assets and resources involved have dropped in a given day. It's just that there happened to be a fraction of people who needed to sell, maybe to raise money for other activities, or they just wanted to get out. So while we don't want to use the stock market as a indicator of prosperity and human flourishing and true values, it's really more of a smaller piece of the economy. The entire economy, what we refer to as gross domestic product, is more of what I was thinking or mentioning earlier with the value that's created in the market through the market process day in and day out. So the stock market does tend to be very nimble and efficient at capturing the current information of the moment. So the changes that happen in the stock market up or down, there's people that are very forward-looking that are trying to stay in the know so that they can turn a quick profit or avoid a short-term loss. And so the changes in the market do reflect information very nicely. But some of that information is not long-term information. And so people like Warren Buffett, for instance, have for years made a lot of money looking for that undervalued asset, because when the stock market drops, a lot of people run for cover, and Warren Buffett starts looking for deals because he can analyze the true underlying value of the company and see that, oh, the current stock price, that's just because people were running for cover. That's a bargain right now. I'm going to buy. And so the market will correct itself back to the long term after the panic has subsided. There hasn't been a stock market recovery that hasn't come back in fairly short order all the way back to the Great Recession, or the Great Depression, rather. If you look at mutual funds like the S&P 500 and other, you know, indices, most of those recover all of the mutual funds within a five-year period, even after a major shock. So whether that's John F. Kennedy or one of the wars,
9/11,
wars in 9/11, yep, all of those. The data is pretty clear that those stock market shocks will correct themselves in fairly short order. So the long story is, the short of the story is, hold on to your money. Don't panic and sell, because right now, if the stock is low, this is the time you'd want to buy it and be a part of the recovery. And so too often people are mistiming the market because they're getting out when it's low and then they miss the climb up. But those dollars are going to recover. And so it's better to just have a longer term strategy for your stocks. And if you're in it for a minimum of a 5 to 10 year window, so like most people's retirements and 401ks, just keep putting it in the equities, even if they're down. So I like to use what's called a dollar cost averaging technique, where The stock market's up, you put your $100 in. Next week when you get your paycheck, the stock market's down, you put your $100 in. So you have a fixed amount. And sometimes you look like a stock market genius because one of those $100 investments will be at the lower turning point of the stock market, and you'll actually make a lot of money on that $100. And then sometimes your $100, you'll look like a loser because you put it in at the very height of the market. But if you do that over the course of a long period of time, you're going to capture the long-term stock market average of usually around 10%, 8 to 12%. And that's a better way to approach stocks. So I personally don't get too rocked when the stock market changes because I have always followed that kind of long-term stuff ever since I was in high school and I did my first penny stock and lost $500 in a matter of a year or two by picking a single stock. I learned my lesson early and have avoided that ever since.
Yeah, okay. So you're not particularly worried about the stock market. You mentioned the national debt. What else are you watching? What else is just, you're looking at the instrument panel and you see, you know, that it's in the red or it's, you know, it's at the top or it's at the bottom. I mean, what else are you looking at? What are your indicators right now that you're watching closely?
I think this is not going to be your typical indicator, so I might have to come back. But I think people's sentiment towards having more involvement with government, I don't know which direction that's going to head. But here we had a major, government's going to step in and rescue us. And I hope that the detriment to that isn't too bad, but I guess bad enough that people recognize that we can't run the economy in a, forgive me those listeners who are Bernie Sanders fans, but in a Bernie Sanders type of way, where it is more centrally planned. This type of crisis did involve a lot of central planning or centralized planning by the experts. But so much of our prosperity actually comes from the decentralized efforts of individuals making those voluntary exchanges. And if we have a larger government sector, then the government is making more decisions and less decisions are being made by the private sector. If you have from a longer term anyway, ignoring kind of deficit issues, if you have a 20% tax rate and you've got $1,000, that means you've got 800 of it to go pick and choose what you want to do, whether that's to invest in something or to buy consumption goods or however you spend your $800. If the tax rates go up to 30%, that means you've got $700. So the more we have higher levels of government spending, it's ultimately going to require higher levels of taxation, and it's taking money out of private hands. And I think a lot of people are very aware of that, and somehow have faith in centralized power coming with good outcomes. But that's the thing that I'm monitoring the closest, is to say, what are people's feelings with this intervention, and how is this going to ride out? It is possible, by the way, for the private sector to kind of minimize the damage that the deficit could be doing by saving it. And so if the government goes and borrows money, that would tend to drive up interest rates, which is what economists call crowding out. So private investment, people investing in their businesses and buying new equipment and machines, if interest rates are higher, they do less of that. And so the government entering the marketplace and doing borrowing at a high level can tend to crowd out private investment. However, economists Barrow and Ricardo said and figured out that part of that could be saved. And if people actually save the stimulus, if they actually take that $1,200 and save it for a rainy day or save it for future tax liability, was the way the argument went, that will actually lower the interest rate and offset some of the impact that could otherwise be negative through higher interest rates with the government entering the borrowing and lending market.
Yeah. So there you heard Dr. Russ McCullough said, save your stimulus check. Say, put it in, put it away in an interest-bearing account.
I'm a Dave Ramsey follower, so I'm big on not going into consumer debt. I think saving for a rainy day is a good thing if you don't have a sufficient fund already, but certainly the government's going to come knocking on our door for a little payback at some point in the future. So on the flip side, some people really need that $1,200, right? You know, to make their next rent bill or whatnot. So that's certainly not to diminish that. But I think there's a lot of people with that $1,200 that may have been able to live without it. And I think the moral of the story is don't go buy pizza and chicken wings, as I tell my students, tuck it away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've been talking to Dr. Russ McCullough, who is the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics at Ottawa University and founder and director of the Gwartney Institute for Freedom, Justice, and Human Flourishing, also within the confines of Ottawa University. Do you watch the unemployment rate? Is that a concern for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hard not to be a concern with what's been going on. So I guess the preliminary estimates, there's always a lag time behind getting the actual unemployment numbers. Some of the early estimates are saying we are going to be higher than the Great Depression, which was 25%. And we were at record lows prior to this pandemic.
Yes.
By having to force the stay-at-home orders and to close non-essential businesses, I mean, essentially the government put a bunch of people out of work. And I'm not saying that wasn't the right thing to do, but by law, we changed the law of the land to say you're out of a job, and that there's really no other way that could have possibly happened than to go from 3% to potentially 30%. In a matter of weeks is amazing. Now here's the sunny side to that thing of that argument though. This pandemic is different than a war. You know, some people have likened it to a situation of a war and maybe a natural disaster or something where, you know, the economy could be wiped out like down in Haiti and other places. One of the big differences is that our infrastructure is just sitting there idle. So as soon as we have some sort of viable solution or path to keeping people safe, we can instantly start utilizing the machines and buildings computers and other things that are just sitting idle, what economists call capital. So that idle capital is just sitting there. It wasn't destroyed by a bomb or it wasn't washed away from a hurricane. It is just sitting there. And so I think that the unemployment numbers and other states of affair can rebound much quicker than they might otherwise be under different circumstances. And so I think that's a real plus kind of hiding there in all the negatives, is that if we can get to a point where we can get people back into the economy, we should see those numbers correct themselves fairly quickly. And there hasn't been too big of a distortion to the capital structure, which again, taking Haiti or some other place into account, they have to go in and rebuild, you know, utilities and roads. And, you know, you can think about the delays to actually rebuilding something could be years. We don't have that problem. We should be able to walk out the door and start utilizing that capital again. And so,
Yeah, I think it's also going to stir up an entrepreneurial spirit. I think people who have some time to think right now are, you know, and maybe have had some ideas. I also think in the nonprofit world, some of the, you know, it's very difficult to make personnel changes. You know, you care for people or they've been there a while. I think they're going to come out leaner. I think their overhead is going to be lower. I think they're going to be more efficient. I think they'll be more productive. And I know that's going to be painful in the real estate and rental markets and what have you. But I think, you know, in the long term, that could be a very, very healthy thing. And would you agree?
Yeah, I think we will be more productive, which will ultimately lead to greater prosperity as well. with that being leaner, so to speak. I think we did a major correction from the financial crisis in 2008, where kind of a similar thing, where you, of course, people who were let go or whatnot were the ones that weren't as productive for you, or that, you know, you might have done otherwise. So we had a similar thing like that. But these new skills that we're learning, I think will allow us to be more productive in the workplace when we return to what it looks like now. And so I think it's going to be a complementary type of thing, these new skills and distancing, social distancing skills that we've been subject to. When we get back face-to-face, I think these additional skills that we've learned will be enhancing to productivity. And so I think that that could be a real hidden gem for us as well.
Yeah, yeah. Before, and we've just got a few minutes, I want to make sure people know how they can get in touch with you. Again, Twitter account is at 123PovertySucks. We have www.GwartneyInstitute.org, and Gwartney is G-W-A-R-T-N-E-Y, Institute, Gwartney Institute. But the link is on the show explanation. So people, it's in pink. If somebody just goes on to the show explanation, they can click on there, and that will take them to the Gwartney Institute website. And so as we close, final question, you know, I read an article this morning, you know, the African economies could just collapse. What impact does this have in world markets? Who knows? And that's a broad topic. What are your thoughts there? You've traveled some, you've seen the people, you've read. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the impact to life in a lot of the developing areas that I've traveled to could be devastating, where they're already living, you know, paycheck to paycheck, so to speak, which means food in their bellies. My wife has talked to some of the Guatemalan families that with her organization, Education and More, and it's been difficult. And there's a lot of people piled into one place. And I think the corrections there won't be as easy. I think there's an old saying that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Mm-hmm. And so the quicker the United States rebounds with this, and if I'm optimistically looking at it correctly, that our rebound will be solid and sound. Hopefully that will flow through to the developing countries, especially those that have positioned themselves to engage in international trade and to be ready to work with the world or continue to work with the world. It might have been put on hold just like we are, but they should be able to rebound quicker as well. So certainly my thoughts and prayers are out to them, and hopefully this could lead to some positive changes in those places as well, if we see the recovery different in different places.
Yeah, and I've been trying to keep my readers and listeners up to date on I'm closest to the work and situation in Kenya. We have one pastor and his family care for 72 orphans. They're all home.
Oh, wow.
They don't understand social distancing. They don't have access to masks and hand sanitizer, and they shop every day. I mean, they have no electricity, they have no refrigerators, they have no running water. And, you know, this is how they've lived, and they're not panicking because they've learned how to do this. Their election 3 or 4 years ago, they had to shut down for a month. I mean, nobody went out because there were dangers and potential violence. And so on the one hand, I'm trying to keep folks, we are still blessed. I'm not saying people are not struggling, but we want to keep that in perspective, and at the same time be mindful of those. And I've been raising a little bit of money that is available to them as they need it, and it has made all the difference in the world. And so we're going to take a little bit of our stimulus check and make sure we invest it in the poor, whether it's in this country or someplace else, because that's just good biblical economics, and we want to be mindful of that concept as well. Well, Dr. Russ, thank you for your time. Any final words, any final thoughts as we close out our session?
Well, John, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and enjoyed my time with you in various ways. And so I hope that we can look at the pandemic crisis with eyes wide open to see benefits that people don't think, well, how well did our free market, help this crisis? We obviously need more experts and more people with their fingers in the mix. I think there'll be lots of opportunities to see how markets can really help, even in dire situations where we do need to clamp down. South Korea was quicker, for instance, at turning towards market production of masks and testing, and they were miles ahead of the United States because of their quicker turn to markets and producers. And so I think there's lots of lessons like that. We all have to kind of step back at some point if we're in the moment and suffering. Hopefully we can get through that and persevere on to better days ahead.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I was supposed to be on campus this week, but obviously it didn't work out. So I don't know when I'll be there again, but I look forward to it. And hopefully the Global Economic and Leadership Forum that we are planning in Malawi will still go on at the end of September. If not, we'll reschedule and do it again. But thank you for your time.
Yes.
Thanks for your contributions to the educational health of our nation and the contributions of Gwartney Institute. And we look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
All right. And good fishing.
All right. Thanks, John.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye. Well, there we had Dr. Russ McCullough, the Wayne Angel Chair of Economics at Ottawa University in Kansas and the founder and director of the Gwartney Institute for Freedom, Justice, and Human Flourishing, www.gwartneyinstitute.org. Gwartney is just how it sounds, Gwartney. GwartneyInstitute.org, and go on Twitter, look for at 123 Poverty Sucks, and Dr. Russ also has a Faith and Economics podcast. And so that wraps it up for today. Tomorrow I have Janice Kelsey. Janice is as a teenager was arrested in Birmingham, Alabama in the civil rights demonstrations there in 1963, and she did a book, I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom. We're going to talk to her tomorrow from down in Birmingham, Alabama, and talk about her book, civil rights issues, and whatever else comes up. A delightful woman. I know you'll enjoy that. But until then, this is John Stanko, and this show is Wake Up to Purpose. We heard Dr. Russ McCullough talk about his purpose of teaching economics with a heart and an emphasis towards relieving the burdens of poverty and the poor. And so tomorrow we'll talk to someone else. We'll be here every day, and I trust you will be too, and that you will be encouraged to find and fulfill your own purpose. Until tomorrow, look for me on Facebook. Write me if I can be of any service. So this is John Stanko signing off. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.